Best known for directing such successes as Adam's Family Values, Get Shorty, and the first three Men in Black movies, Barry Sonnenfeld's importance to modern cinema expands considerably when his cinematographer credits are added to the list. The Coen brothers' first three films, Blood Simple, Raising Arizona, and Miller's Crossing. He also was the director of photography on Throw Mama from the Train, Big, When Harry Met Sally, and Misery. Plus, of course, his television hits, Pushing Daisies and A Series of Unfortunate Events. Now Barry Sonnenfeld joins us to discuss his very funny new memoir, Barry Sonnenfeld, Call Your Mother. His philosophy is regret the past, fear the present, dread the future. Told in his unmistakable voice, the book is a laugh-out-loud memoir about coming of age. Constantly threatened with suicide by his overprotective mother, disillusioned by the father he worshipped, and abused by a demonic relative, Sonnenfeld somehow went on to become one of Hollywood's most successful producers and directors, and it's a great pleasure to welcome him to the roundtable this morning. How are you, sir? Very nice to have you with us.
Thanks, Joe. I'm doing good. I'm here in Telluride, Colorado, self-isolating.
At what point did you think, oh, you know what, now seems like the right time to tell a story of my life?
You know what, it sounds good, but it didn't happen that way at all. As I mentioned, I live in Telluride, Colorado, and one of our neighbors in this very small enclave of four houses is Jerry Seinfeld, and Jerry and his wife and kids would often come to our house because we have a great screening room, and over the holidays we would watch movies, and I would regale Jerry with stories of how difficult it is to be a director in the modern age, because I was directing Men in Black 3, and between the producers and the studio and their concerns and the lack of script, it was really a nightmare making Men in Black 3. And a few years later, Jerry came up to me and said, you know what? You should really try stand-up. You know, you're in charge of your own work. No one tells you what to say or not say. You succeed or fail on your own terms. I think you should do stand-up. And I said, aren't I, like, way too old to start a new career in stand-up, Jerry? And he said, oh, God, you're way too old. You won't make any money doing it, but you might have fun. So I said, well, thanks a lot, Jerry. I'll think about it. And then the more I thought about it, the more I decided that my version of stand-up would be to write my memoir, because my life has been fairly surreal between my parents and various events that have happened in my life, plane crashes, muggings. So the closest I could come to doing stand-up without the fear of in-person rejection was to write my memoir. So Jerry was very instrumental in me writing this book, actually.
You know, just watching you I think the first time I saw you as a guest was on Letterman. And, I mean, it comes off almost like a stand-up act. It seems as though you were so comfortable in that position that you would be able to pull it off and go on stage and be a stand-up. And the stories are just priceless.
Well, Joe, all right, based on that, Joe, I'm going to try a career in stand-up.
There you go.
You know, one of the joys in life, because I've always idolized Letterman, was the fact that I got to not only be on Letterman show, but be on 8 times and often be mean to my mother was just thrilling.
Let's just talk about that. We'll get that out of the way, which, of course,
sure,
is the title of the book, Barry Sonnenfeld, Call Your Mother. You told this story. The first time I heard it was on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. And it was just, it's a great story. You're at Madison Square Garden. Jimi Hendrix is on the stage. What happens?
Jimmy is on stage. It's 2:20 in the morning, 19,600 people, first Earth Day concert. Jimmy's in a bad place. It's the second time he's been on stage warming up, the first time he stormed up. So there's a lot of tension in the air. And just as Jimmy is about to hit his first chord, over the PA system came the title of my book, Barry Sonnenfeld, Call Your Mother. The fact that my mother was able to have anyone answer the phone and convince them that it was such an important thing that she needed desperately to find her son in my mind, can mean only one thing, which is that my father had died. And the thought of living the rest of my life alone with my mother was just horrific. So I start to weep uncontrollably. I, of course, stand up, which announces to the garden that I am deed and Barry Sonnenfeld. So now the chant, which starts in the blue seats because I'm up on the cheap seats of Barry, Barry, starts to grow, starts to move towards Jimmy. I'm on the phone weeping, the payphone, because this is pre-cellular, weeping, thinking my father is dead. And I said, Mom, who died? Because this is 2:20 in the morning. I said, Mom, who died? She said, I thought you did. You said you'd be home at 2, and it's 2:20. I said, didn't they tell you the concert was still going on? She said, yes, but they couldn't confirm you were there. So that was my mother. Very impressive, I would say.
I think it's amazingly impressive, and it does tell you a lot, not only about your mother, but about the dynamic between the two of you.
Yes, you know, it helped fuel my neuroses. You know, my mother said that if I went to sleepaway school, others call it college, she would commit suicide. So I spent 3 years living at home attending NYU until I became a senior and realized, wait, I could go to another school as a senior and my mother would commit suicide.
Mm.
Two birds, one stone. This is fantastic. So I spent my senior year at Hampshire College, and Mom reneged on her threat.
I am curious as to someone who is self-described as neurotic. How are you getting through? And I mentioned your philosophy, regret the past, fear the present, dread the future.
Right.
My goodness, how are you getting through these days of coronavirus?
Well, you know, luckily we live on 65 acres in Telluride, Colorado, where really my fears are much more about ghosts and aliens. Especially when I have to walk the dog at night. You don't want to see me doing that. I constantly make 360 turns because I think I've sensed something. Or why is the dog suddenly staring up at the sky? It can only mean one thing, an alien. So for me, there's a lot of fear here. But because we're self-isolating and we've got several refrigerators and too many packages of beans that we've already ordered years ago, I think we're going to be fine, but I think it's very devastating and fearful, and I don't know what's going to happen to the world, but I think Sweetie and I are going to be okay if we just stay out of the way.
Let me ask you about your career. You obviously write about this, but it was never your intention to be a director. And we can talk about how that happened in a moment. But what was your intention? Was it always to be a cinematographer?
No. You know, if you asked me until I was 26 what I wanted to do, I would say I have no clue. I thought maybe I wanted to be an architect. I thought at one point I wanted to be an FM disc jockey. I mean, my heroes were the guys that were on WNEW in New York, Scott Muni and Roscoe and Allison Bird.
All right.
And Allison Steele, the Nightbird. Those were who I listened to alone every night, but I didn't really think I had what you would call a radio voice. I graduated undergraduate school with a degree in political science because all the courses met Monday, Wednesday, and Thursday, which meant I only had to do 3 days of college a week since I was living at home. And I went to NYU Graduate Film School for lack of anything better to do because I also thought maybe I wanted to be a still photographer or wanted to be Jack Kerouac. And I thought, you know, maybe film is kind of like still photography and writing. It turns out it isn't at all. But when I got out of film school, I discovered I had an ability to shoot movies and to light movies. And I discovered a different way to shoot movies, which is that I felt the camera could not only be a recording device, but actually a character in the movie. So if you look at, you know, Blood Simple, Raising Arizona, 3 o'clock High, Throw Mama, Adam's Family, the camera is a very active participant in the movie. And that's something that I sort of created for myself. So I accidentally became a cameraman. But that, you know, I always tell people, figure out what you want to do in life and declare yourself as that's what you are. And you figure out a way to make money doing it. And that's kind of what happened to me. It was all fairly accidental.
Barry Sonnenfeld is our guest. The name of the new book is Barry Sonnenfeld, Call Your Mother, Memoirs of a Neurotic Filmmaker. You talk, it's one of my favorite stories in the book, but you talk about how one of the jobs that you really wanted, you'd worked with the Coen brothers, one of the jobs that you really wanted is to work on Big, directed by Penny Marshall, starring Tom Hanks.
Right.
You go in, and what happens?
Well, first of all, when I went in, I was going to star Robert De Niro, which would have been interesting, by the way. I go in. I really want this job. There's a guy, Bobby Greenhut, who is a producer who also produced all the Woody Allen movies. I lived outside of New York, and he was the New York producer. This was going to be a big movie and really change my career. So I really wanted this job. And I go in, and I meet Bobby and Penny Marshall, and Penny is chain smoking, and I can barely see her through the haze. And she spends about 20 minutes going on about what she thinks the visual style is. And I always know that you can't figure out a visual style before you start to shoot, because you set these rules and they all go wrong. You know, Penny was saying the camera should be naive when Hanks is a kid and be sophisticated when Hanks is an adult. And I don't know how to manifest a naive camera versus a sophisticated camera. So I said to her, so after 20 minutes, Penny says to me, well, what do you think? What do you think we should do? And I really wanted the job, but I couldn't help myself. I said, would it be okay if I just made it look nice? And Penny turned to Greenhut and said, nice would be good. And Greenhut said, thanks for coming. And I was ushered out, and that was the entire interview. My interview consisted of me saying 11 words. Would it be okay if I just made it look nice? And about 6 weeks later, 8 weeks later, Greenhut called me and said, you know, we're going to start in 10 weeks. I still don't have our cameraman. So I said, why don't I just hire that idiot Sonnenfeld? And I refused to be hired on those terms. I said, I demand another interview. And he said, schmuck, I'm hiring you. And I said, not as the idiot Sonnenfeld. So I insisted on another interview. Got it. He said, we're looking for the cheapest cameraman. I said, that I can do. So I got the job. And then I discovered that Penny and I had very different ways of working. And in fact, although Penny and I liked each other as people, Penny hated what I was doing with the camera. She tried to fire me at the end of the first week. And it was not an enjoyable experience because Penny didn't like my camera work at all. Until she saw the finished product, and then she said to me, I swear to you, when I showed her the final answer print that was about to go out to, you know, 1,800 theaters, she said, I never thought you were a good cameraman, but you picked a good film stock. So she couldn't even tell me that it looked nice, except because I picked the right film stock.
Well, and as
but
you...
that was Penny.
Yeah, and as you point out in the book, I mean, you were in good company in the sense that she never thought Tom Hanks was a particularly good actor.
That's correct. The same the day that the movie was going to open, it was Friday night. I was visiting Tom Hanks on the set of his new movie, which was called Burbs, and I was in his camper with Tom, and we were commiserating that day in the Los Angeles Times. Penny had an interview about the opening of Big, and Penny said, I never thought Tom was a particularly good actor, so I surrounded him with other better actors to make him look good. And there I was in the camper with Hanks, and a production assistant knocked on the door and said, we're ready for you, Tom, on the set. And Tom yelled back, are there a lot of good actors out there? I'm not coming out unless there are a lot of good actors. But Tom is so self-confident, and he's such a great actor, and we got along so well, Tom and I did, on that movie, that it was that's what made it joyful, was being on the set every day with Tom.
You then eventually get into directing, and you're hired by Scott Rudin. You have amazing Scott Rudin stories in the book. This is the king of Broadway now, right? I mean, this is the guy. And
yes.
I'm curious as to that relationship and then how ultimately he was able to talk you into directing Addams Family.
Well, I was a successful cinematographer. I was not looking to direct, but Scott had been the president of production at Fox when I was doing both Big and also Raising Arizona, which were both for Fox. So he knew my work pretty well, and he had seen dailies and really saw what I did for those movies. So Scott one day sent me the script to Addams Family. I was finishing up filming Misery for Rob Reiner. You know, he said, I want you to direct this script. And I was not looking to be a director or anything like that. And there I was. So I said, look, if you can get me a job directing, fine, I'll direct this movie. And Scott got me the job. But the thing about Scott is, my quote about Scott Rudin is, I love him and I wish he were dead. He's truly brilliant. He's got amazing taste. He's a brilliant producer. He goes up against the studio for the betterment of the movie, but he also sort of yells and lies. So luckily I was used to the lying because of my mother. But one of the great ways I dealt with Scott is I realized when he would yell at me, I could out-juvenile him. So whenever he would start to yell, I would, and we were often in his office, I'd take all the pillows off of his couch, build a fort out of the pillows on the couch, crawl into the fort, close the pillow, and yell out loud, I can't hear you, I'm in the fort. And Scott, being the juvenile that he is, which I adore about him, would never invade the sanctity of the fort. He'd scream at me, get out of there, get out of the fort. Come on, Sonnenfeld, I don't have time for this. And I say, I can't hear you, I'm in the fort. But he would never, ever just lift up a pillow and say, schmuck, there is no fort. So eventually I'd say, you have to apologize. He'd apologize, I'd climb out of the fort, rebuild the couch, and we would move on with the day's work.
You write in the book, there are two extreme versions of Scott Rudin and nothing in between. He is compassionate, sweet, lovely, warm, brilliant, a great listener and a wonderful collaborator. He is ruthless, pathological, a liar, mean, a dictator, and a lousy collaborator.
Let me say this about Scott. He's read the book and loves it.
There you go.
There you go.
Barry Sonnenfeld is our guest. The name of the new book is Barry Sonnenfeld, Call Your Mother, Memoirs of a Neurotic Filmmaker. We will continue our conversation after this short break. Barry Sonnenfeld is our guest. The name of the new book is Barry Sonnenfeld, Call Your Mother, Memoirs of a Neurotic Filmmaker. So, the first time directing, did you feel, I mean, it doesn't come off in the book that this was the best experience of your life, but did you feel as though at least you were doing something that you liked to do?
It was so hard, truthfully, and the stress was extraordinary. I had never done it before. Scott was very difficult and very demanding. Our studio, Orion, was going bankrupt. So we had to sell our movie halfway through to Paramount. I don't write about it in the book because I don't write much about the production, but that was another nightmare because I kept fainting, which is very unmanly for a director to faint on the set surrounded by their actors. So I did not have a good time doing it, and I couldn't imagine that it was going to work out. And we had the greatest editor, Dee Dee Allen, who cut Reds and Bonnie and Clyde and Slapstick and all these amazing movies, and she was fantastically helpful. The movie finally comes out. At that time, there was a movie slump. The industry was in a bad place. We were a huge hit. Our opening weekend was twice what was predicted. I was getting calls all weekend long when the movie opened from all these studio executives congratulating me. And finally, Scott Rudin called me Sunday night and said, congratulations. And I said, well, you know, Scott, I would have loved the movie. It's like a child. Even if it didn't do well, I would have loved it. And besides, there are so many other people that need credit, the distribution people, the marketing people. I started to go on, and Scott Rudin sagely said, Barry, if you can't be happy today, your mother won. And I realized, wow, he's right. I'm going to fake being happy. Because here, let me tell you something. Here's the secret to life. There's no upside to optimism. There's only upside to pessimism. And here's why. If every time you get on a plane, you turn to your wife or friend and say, I bet before we get to LA, this plane is going to crash. One of two things happen. If the plane starts to nosedive to the ground, you get to elbow your friend or your wife and say, hey, am I right or what? That's a win. And if it doesn't crash and you get to LA, you didn't die. Also a win. There's only upside in pessimism. And if your audience can take anything away from this interview, you're welcome.
And yes, indeed. Thank you. The name of the book is Barry Sonnenfeld, Call Your Mother. We were talking about David Letterman, who is one of my favorite humans. And so I just want to talk a little bit about that, because you go on the show to promote Men in Black, and they do the pre-interview, and right. you tell them a whole bunch of stuff about you and your wife, Sweetie, and about your mom and stories and the story that you told earlier about the Jimi Hendrix concert. But there is a point where they come back to you and say, yeah, Dave thinks that the material about your mom may be a little dark, a little rough. And then you go out, and of course, anyone who would know knows David Letterman. That's exactly where he wanted to go.
Well, I told the segment producer, I said, tell Dave I'll go wherever he wants. Don't worry about anything being too rough. So, of course, Dave says, you have an interesting relationship with your mother. And I said, well, until he died, my mother could have been Vincent Gardenia's photo double, which gets a big laugh. Now, I don't know this, but because I'm pre-interviewed, they're ready just in case with an 8x10 photo of Vincent Gardenia. So Dave holds it up to the camera, huge laugh. I look at the photo and go, well, mom has more facial hair. By the way, Letterman, one of the highlights of my life, including the fact that my wife, Sweetie, married me, which is just amazing considering how difficult I am as a person to live with, you know, full of dread, fear, and angst. But one of the greatest moments of my life is when the second time I was on Letterman, during the commercial break, Dave leaned over and talked to me. And the other seven times I was, because Dave never does that. Dave's famous during the commercials to, you know, talk to the producers, whatever, just to avoid having to talk to the guest. And so a highlight was Dave talking to me. But I think meaner than me talking about my mother looking like Gardenia was, when Men in Black did come out, I was quoted, Newsweek had a cover story on Men in Black, and in it, it says that Barry Sonnenfeld is very neurotic, and he used to walk around the set saying to every grip and electrician, I'll give you $400,000 to get me off this movie or kill my mother. So my mother reads about this in Newsweek, calls me up and says, do you really... She's weeping, of course, and says, do you really wish I were dead? And I said, Mom, I promise you, I would never pay someone $400,000 to kill you. And my mother said, thank you, Barry. I love you very much.
I want to talk about some of my favorites of your projects. You don't write about it much in the book, and that is Pushing Daisies. I love that show. That was great. I'm interested of how that came about. And you were talking about your use of the camera. Well, that is just that show, and also a series of fortunate events very similar in that regard. But it was so visually perfect.
Well, first of all, thank you very much. Thanks, Joe. second of all, I couldn't write about everything in the book. In fact, my first draft was 80% longer, and I removed 11 chapters, so I'm about a third of the way through the sequel if this one does well enough, just so you know. So I didn't write about Men in Black. I didn't write about Pushing Daisies or a series of unfortunate events, all seminal moments in my life. So I was sent a script to Pushing Daisies. I was here in Telluride, Colorado, and I said to my wife, whoever directs this script, if they do a good job, will win an Emmy. And I won the Emmy, so I was right. So it's a fantastic script written by Brian Fuller, who is also the executive producer. We got along great. We had a fantastic cast with Lee Pace, who I finally was able to teach how to talk fast. And once he talked fast, he was fantastic in the movie. My secret to all acting is to get the actors to talk fast, because until they talk fast, they have a chance to act. And the last thing you ever want to do is watch an actor act. It's painful. But if you make them talk fast enough, they can't act, and then it's really good. And Lee did an amazing job. We had a great production designer, Michael Wiley. And again, for me, storytelling, part of storytelling is script, it's acting, but it's also camera. And the funny thing is, I'm usually a low angle guy, but in that movie, I use a lot of high angles because I often wanted to, in effect, have God's point of view, because it's such a surreal movie concept, you know, that you can bring people back to life. So it's perhaps one of the two favorite things I've ever done, the other being the 3 years of a series of unfortunate events. It's funny that the two things I've most enjoyed actually are television shows, which is interesting. But I loved working on Pushing Daisies, and also Ellen Green and Susie Kurtz and Kristen Chenoweth and Anna Friel. It was perfection.
I was going to ask you about that, because I interviewed Norman Lear a while back when he had his autobiography out, and he was telling me that one of the many secrets to his success, he believed, especially with All in the Family, is that he was finding these great out-of-work New York theater actors and bringing them in to do these shows. And I thought of that when I was watching Pushing Daisies and reading your book, because, I mean, you just listed them, but Lee Pace, Kristen Chenoweth, Susie Kurtz, Ellen Green, my goodness, these are some of the greatest names in stage acting, and here you have put them to perfect use in this television vehicle.
Well, you know, Rob Reiner, actually, who was on Norman Lear's show, you know, All in the Family, Rob and I often talk about how casting is directing. We joke that if you have the right script and you have the right cast, you're 90% there, and the only thing a director can do is sort of screw it up. But look at Adam's Family. You wouldn't think that Angelica Houston and Raul Julia were going to be the leads of a, you know, fairly big budget at the time comedy, you know, and Scott Rudin, God love him, was able to convince the studio that's who we wanted, because we did, and they were perfect. You know, the studio wanted Cher. They didn't want Angelica. I don't remember who they wanted instead of Raul, but they wanted a TV actor, and we kept saying, no, these characters needed to be played by Raul and Angelica. Same with, you know, really a series of unfortunate events is filled with stage actors. K. Todd Freeman, who plays Mr. Poe,
yep.
Neil Patrick Harris, who doesn't have a lot of movie stuff. all these actors are just the right act. Patrick Warburton is not a feature, really a big feature actor, but he's a fantastic actor. And so you surround yourself with the best actors and get a good script, and then all you can do is screw it up as a director. And that's been my philosophy.
Well, far from screwing it up. So the two things to me, there are many things, but two things huge, as far as I'm concerned, that they have in common is the lush, incredible color of them.
Right.
And also the fact that they have a narrator.
That's true. I forgot. The difference is a series of unfortunate events. And this is what got me the job, is when I went into Netflix to pitch myself to direct the series. I said to them, I want an on-screen narrator who's omnipresent, who is really narrating from the past, but I want him not to be a guy sitting behind the typewriter writing, you know. I want him to physically be able to walk in and out of scenes. And I love that we did that and we pulled it off, and it became such an iconographic concept for the show. And also Jim Dale, who was in that beautiful, wonderfully voiced narrator on Pushing Daisies, and Jim was Brian Fuller's idea, is just so perfect. And what I love about both narrations is you don't need a narration to tell you what you're already seeing. You need a narration to be an additional joy. And so in the case of Warburton, we often used him to describe the definition of words, like the difference between literal and figurative, and all this stuff. And Jim Dale doesn't really talk about what you're seeing. So I love the concept of narration, as long as it's integrated in a new and unique and wonderful way, which we pulled off on both shows, actually.
When you look for a project, then, when you're done, as you say, you've had these two successes of the things that you're proud of, we're both in television. So what do you look for in a project, and what do you see yourself, realizing a lot is up in the air here as we speak, but of what you look to as a next project?
In general, I tend towards comedies. I've never not done a comedy. You know, one thing about comedies is you get to see dailies and know if that scene works or not. If you're doing a drama or a mystery, until you put the whole thing together, the scenes kind of seem kind of boring. So I really like working in comedy. It's a way I get to have the actors talk fast. So almost 90% of the scripts I received are some version of either comedic or quirky or unusual. Again, the other thing I'm drawn to, if you look at the stuff I've done, is not straight-ahead romantic comedies. They tend to be off in some way, whether it's Adam's Family or even the Men in Black movies, which I think are just weird buddy movies, or Pushing Daisies or A Series of Unfortunate Events. They tend to be dark, they tend to be quirky, and they tend to be original. So that's what I look for. Don't send me your legal drama, Joe.
No, I wouldn't think of it. But it does. You use the word off. But reading your life story, I mean, that seems to follow through, doesn't it? Things are just a little bit off.
Oh, things are very off. Everything I do, I feel, is an autobiography. You know, what I say about A Series of Unfortunate Events and why I love the book so much is Daniel Handler posits that, you know, children are capable and wonderful, and adults, whether they mean well or are villainous, are all equally sort of ineffectual. And that was my parents. And I was the Baudelaire orphans. I begged my parents all their lives. I begged them, please tell me I'm adopted. Please, I beg you. And they refused to. They insisted I was there from their loins. And that's so depressing to me.
You also you do talk about your beautiful relationship with your wife, Sweetie, who you've been married over 30 years, right?
That's right.
Give us a sense of I don't know how to say this nice, but she is able to put up with all of the interesting of that off nature that we were just talking about.
You know, I think she was very concerned when we started to talk about marriage because she knew my parents and felt I had terrible role models. And, you know, was really concerned that I would turn out to be one of my parents. In a way, there's a little bit of both of them. You know, I have my mother's fears and my father's sort of idiotic salesmanship. You know, I'll go up to strangers and go, "Hey, how are you doing?" And then my wife and daughter will go, "Oh, Jesus, you're being sunny." That was the name of my father. But sweetie, you know, somehow when I turned to her, as I write in the book, when I turned to her over Kansas on some airplane and I go, "The engines just changed pitch. We're over Kansas in the middle of nowhere. This plane is going down. Something is wrong." She's able to say, "Nothing's wrong. Planes change direction, even in the middle of Kansas. They fly from one VOR to another. Everything's okay." And I go, "Not this time. This time is different. We're going to crash." And she goes, "Okay, well, I'm going to go back to my nap, and I'll see you when we land in L.A. And I go, "We're not landing in L.A. We're going to go down, like, either over Kansas or Colorado." And she says, "Whatever. Okay, fine." So she's very capable of dealing with my neuroses, and I'm willing to put up with her stupid optimism.
My final question to you, you've obviously done so much in your career, and you have a lot to be proud of. Do you believe your parents should get some credit for that?
No. Yes, okay, all right, yes. Look, I say in the book that where we all are now is an amalgamation of quintillion decisions made by us, bus drivers we've never met, people walking across the street. Everything is this quantum thing that keeps changing by the millisecond. And if you go back and regret, and I know I say regret the past, I regret it, but I'm not saying I should have done anything different. And so I have to admit that I would not be here today if my parents weren't profoundly narcissistic. I mean, my mother was, you know, artistic and did tell me to go to graduate school. She lied and said they would pay for it. And of course, they had no money. We were constantly not with power phone, and we had to avoid Lou the Butcher. So there's that. But I can't say I wouldn't be here with this dark, unusual sense of humor if I didn't have such a miserable experience growing up. So I guess I can thank them for that. How's that for a backwards compliment?
It's a great answer. Barry Sonnenfeld, Call Your Mother is the name of the new memoir. It is published by Hachette. Barry Sonnenfeld, what a pleasure to talk to you. I thank you so much for taking the time out. I wish you all the luck in the world, and I just am such a fan of your work, and it's a great delight to chat with you.
Well, Joe, thank you so much. And if people don't want to read it, they can listen to it and download it on audible.com and hear 11 hours of this voice speaking in their heads. So there's that for another version of surreal life. And thank you, Joe. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Great pleasure. Thank you. Again, the name of the book, Barry Sonnenfeld, Call Your Mother, Memoirs of a Neurotic Filmmaker. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.
Who am I? What am I doing? Don't you miss the vivid imagination of childhood?
I never had one.
An imagination or a childhood?